The Planning Commission will come to order. Commissioner Heatherington will lead us in the pledge.
Please follow me. I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Roll call, please. And for the record, Commissioner Slane has an excused absence.
Commissioner Heatherington?
Present.
Commissioner Jack?
Here.
Commissioner Marks?
Here.
Commissioner O'Grady?
Here.
Vice Chairperson Fonzie?
Here.
Chairperson O'Keefe?
Here. We have some rules of decorum to the speakers. Please direct your comments to the entire commission and not to individuals. Please do not use slanderous, profane, or negative personal remarks concerning individuals absent or present. To the audience, I ask that you be respectful and courteous to the speakers and refrain from vocal expression of approval or disapproval, such as clapping or heckling. And is there a motion to approve the agenda?
So moved.
Second.
Moved and seconded. Roll call.
Commissioner Jack?
Yes.
Commissioner Marks?
Yes.
Commissioner Heatherington?
Yes.
Commissioner O'Grady?
May I ask a question before I vote? There's a new agenda. Is that different from the one that was included in our commissioner packet?
I didn't see a new agenda.
Well, this was sitting here at my seat when I arrived this evening, and I briefly compared it, and I couldn't tell a difference.
Well, let's ask staff.
If I can jump in here, Annette emailed me last week that there was a typographical error, so she upgraded. I think that's all it is.
Okay. In that case, I vote yes.
Okay.
And Vice Chairperson Fonzie?
Yes.
Chairperson O'Keefe?
Yes.
6-0. Motion passes.
Disclosure of ex parte communications. I'll start with Commissioner Heatherington.
Nothing to report.
I visited site on item number 2 and discussed the item with my family.
I also visited the site, but no ex parte communication.
Okay. Order of business on a future agenda. Is there anybody who wants to speak at public comment time? Seeing none, I'll close it to public comment, and we'll move on to the consent calendar. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Second.
Moved and seconded. Roll call.
Commissioner Jack?
Yes.
Commissioner O'Grady?
Yes.
Commissioner Marks?
Yes.
Commissioner Heatherington?
Yes.
Vice Chairperson Fonzie?
Yes.
Chairperson O'Keefe?
Yes.
6-0. Motion passes.
Okay, we have only one staff report, and that's for tree removal.
Good evening, Commissioners. The tree removal permit that we're looking at tonight is at 5250 Ardea Road. This site is located towards the north end of Ardea. It's about 2 sites up from the tree removal permit we looked at a few months ago. This site is zoned RSFZ, which requires 1.5 to 2.5 acre minimum, and it's currently vacant. This is original colony lot with coast live oaks, blue oaks, and valley oaks. There's very dense tree canopy on the site. The site is located at the top of the drainage swale, so the drainage comes off from the hill above and runs through the center of the site. Here you can see where the drainage becomes more of a swale towards the bottom of the site. And this is the location of the proposed residence. Here's a site plan of the proposed residence. The drainage would come off the hill behind and go through a catch basin underneath the driveway. The drainage well is located down here in the south part of the site with a leach field located up towards the road. The residence is proposed in this location with the retaining wall on the one corner behind. Here we see some sections of the proposed residence. The 6-foot retaining wall would require some cut behind the residence, and then there would be some amount of fill in the driveway location. This would raise the driveway about 5 feet so that it would meet fire department standards for access into the garage area for the fire truck to park in this location. The septic system is located near Ardea Road, and it does maintain a 50-foot setback from the swale, as required by the city's plumbing code. The arborist has recommended a deep pit expansion system, which is shown here, and this would reduce any further tree impacts in the future if the main septic system were ever to fail. The applicant has rerouted the septic system since the original plans in order to avoid most of the oak trees, and that will be removed or impacted more than 45% by the residents. The ones in red will be the trees that will be, need to be removed, and the ones in blue are going to be impacted. The city does require tree mitigation for these removals, and will also require a mitigation deposit for all the trees that are impacted over 45%. It's $883 for the removed trees and $791, which will be held. And if the trees do survive, that will be refunded. There are conditions and mitigation measures included in this resolution: tree protection fencing, arborist monitoring, on-site pre-construction meeting, and a final status report will be required. All the utilities will be located within the driveways. These are the findings that are shown in your staff report, and staff is recommending that the Planning Commission approve the tree removals as conditioned. And that concludes staff's presentation.
Are there any questions? Commissioner Hetherington.
I noticed the for sale sign up on the property when I was there. This is project specific where the trees are coming out. Now, what happens if this property sells and somebody can come back and say, we want to redesign this and we want to take out more trees? Could you kind of flesh that out for me?
Well, the trees won't be able to be removed until the permit is actually issued. That's the way that tree removals are designed, so that they come in and pay their mitigation fees with their permit. So if a permit was actually issued and they started work on a site, chances are we'd probably see that permit completing. If they decided to not to pick up those plans at all and start over something new, then the trees would not be removed and the new applicant would have to come in with another tree removal permit.
Thank you. Any other questions? Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I'm curious. The assessor's parcel map indicates it's 1.35 acres. Is RSF Z is 1.5 to 2.5, and your report says it's 1.4 acres.
Our city's GIS system, we have approximate numbers, they're not always exact. 1.4 is what we have in our system. Since this is an original colony lot, a lot of times these are non-conforming lots. Okay. So it is still...
The cost for extending the sewer was prohibitive. What is that cost, or what is the cost difference between extending the sewer and putting in a septic?
The applicant got some quotes on that. He believes it's about $30,000 to extend the sewer up to the property. I'm not sure what the cost on the septic system would be, so that'd probably be best referred to the applicant.
Commissioner Jack?
One quick question. So our scope tonight is to deal with the trees only?
Yes. Okay. That would be what's before you tonight.
Thank you.
Commissioner Fonsi?
I have a question regarding the drainage. That it appears that the drainage will go underneath a driveway. Is this following the natural flow of the current swale, or this is slightly different?
It would be slightly different. Here they are doing an interceptor channel, and that flows around the back of the house and underneath the driveway. I think right now the drainage would just flow through the site location. So in this case, they're redirecting the drainage around the house.
That's kind of the way it looked to me, too, when I looked at it on site. And I wondered if the arborist had considered the impacts that changing the water channel and the water flow would have on existing trees that would be left behind.
I know that the percent impacts do take into consideration any trenching for the new drainage, but I need to ask the arborist about the water amounts.
I have a question, again, going back to the sewer. The previous project that we looked at, now, where did they bring the sewer line from? Was that from
It was, originally they brought it from the very bottom of Ardea, down south of the church.
Okay.
That's down there.
And how much did it cost that applicant to do that?
I don't know the exact numbers. I believe it was pretty high. I think we're looking upwards of $50,000.
And so if this applicant were to connect with the sewer, would he have to give a reimbursement for part of the cost for the original extension?
No, they would not have to do that. They would just have to pay for the extension up to their property.
And how many feet was the original when it was brought up from?
I think it was at least 1,000 feet. It was at 5 or 6 properties that they brought it up, and
sewer line that was run up there. We have been inspecting it, and they did hit considerable rock and had some trouble building that original sewer line that's extended up to that street. So, but I do not know the construction cost of that.
Okay.
They will be filing a reimbursement map on that particular extension. When they do file a reimbursement map, we will know the exact cost. But they have 6 months to record that map from the time they finish their sewer extension.
Okay, and would you explain what you mean by reimbursement cost?
Well, what happens is the applicant, or the X is, has the authority to file a reimbursement map with the city. Anybody along that line, such as the church, who is hooking into this line, that hooks in would have to pay their pro rata cost of the construction of that main back to the individual who paid for it. But as alluded to earlier by Callie, the extension further up to the new properties would not have to pay the reimbursement. And the reason for that is if you kept on requiring people to pay the reimbursement of the old line they just connected into, you would never stop the reimbursement chain.
Okay. And then I have another question. It looks like they've put in the sewer, and what I've seen there is they've, you know, filled it in, but there's a depression, and Ardella Road is in pretty bad shape already. And I see you've always said water is what is most destructive to the road, so it's already sinking. I mean, there's a depression there.
That's correct. The term we use is water is asphalt's enemy. But anyway, we will require that depression to be fixed. Currently, they're still working on fixing that trench. We will not allow the trench to remain settled. And on these old roads, it is a problem when we go in there and they put in a sewer line. There's failures around the trenches, so it is a difficult situation.
Okay. You have a question?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I know we're dealing with trees. Why was this new sewer line put in?
The gentleman where the X is wanted to put it in, and the church was interested in participating with him. I do not know, you know, what his motivation was, but he wanted to put in a sewer main, so he paid for the design and the construction of the main.
I think there were two reasons. Some people in the audience said that percolation was not good, but additionally there would have been a lot more impacts to the trees on that other property, so there were less environmental impacts by expending the funds to put in the sewer, bring the sewer line up.
And I also know that you
probably expected.
The only time that they're required to connect to sewer would be if it was within 200 feet of the property line or it actually touched the property line. So if In the case of the property south of this one, they were only required to bring it up to their own property. And since this other property is farther away, they don't have to extend it up there. Another key difference between these two sites is that the other site, we were looking at about a 45% average slope. On the site that we're still looking at tonight, we're looking at 26% slope. So there's a substantial difference there. I don't believe a septic system would have been permitted on a 45% slope on the other site, so it may not have been able to be developed without the sewer.
What about when a house sells? What does that also trigger sewer, or is it only if there's a problem?
Only if there's a construction, if they're going to be building on site. Or if the septic failed and it was right in front of their house, then they would have to connect.
Okay. But you mean if the leach field failed?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Go ahead.
Just to follow up with Commissioner O'Keefe, I just thought of a question. If there was an accessory structure being applied for that had plumbing in it, would that trigger a connection to the sewer?
No, it would not.
Any other questions? If not, I'll open it to the applicant. You don't have to speak, but the commissioners may have some questions. Please give your name.
Yeah, I'm John Ferguson.
I'm still John Ferguson. Thank you for having me tonight. If you have any questions, I'll do my best to answer.
Go ahead.
Mr. Ferguson, the sewer that you're, or the septic that you're designing for this piece of property, it's not your regular septic system. What is the cost to you as it's designed today?
I'm guessing in the range of $5,000. You know, we're already going to have the heavy equipment on site to do the excavating, so it's not like we're calling somebody out of the phone book to show up with a backhoe and dig this thing. So, you know, incrementally it's... And maybe worth noting, you know, I had this design well before the other applicant that, you know, applied for his sewer. I wasn't even aware that was going to happen until my first submittal was complete. And I concur.
Pit system that I'm not familiar with, and I'd like an explanation of that.
Okay. Are there any other questions of the applicant? Okay, thank you.
Okay, I'd just like to close by saying we did work real hard to position the house to minimize the impact to the trees, to pick a construction design that would really, you know, try to blend the house into the hill as opposed to just, you know, cutting it and putting a 10-foot high retaining wall in the back. And I don't know how much your package includes, but I think, you know, the elevations, I think the way the house fits into the site, I'm actually pretty proud of the job we did to fit that in there without disturbing, you know, the nature of the lot. So
I just want to say I recognize that you worked with the site rather than coming up with your dream house to put on it, and it didn't conform to the lot, so I can see that.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, please state your name.
Chip Tamani with A&T Arborists.
Go ahead, Commissioner Fonsi.
Hi, Chip. Just a question regarding the drainage on the site, that it obviously is changing position, which will perhaps have some impact on the trees. I wondered if you were working with the applicant to accommodate that change in the drainage, or this was before the drainage was changed.
No, we did notice that, and I think the catch basin that's on the uphill side of the house is basically designed to keep sheet flow from coming down on the back side of the house. That water actually... it possibly could have impacted actually a couple of the trees that are going to have to be removed for the house, but after it's rechanneled underneath the driveway, it re-enters almost the exact position of the swale downstream, so there really is going to be no impact to those downstream trees because the water is still going to make it there underneath the driveway at that point.
Great, thank you.
Commissioner O'Grady.
Could you explain this deep pit system? It sounds like you're digging a hole halfway to China or something. I'm sure that's not it. So,
I'm not a sewer expert by any means and don't claim to be. However, the amount of disturbance in the ground for a regular leach field, of course, you can see by looking at the plans, is, you know, quite a big area. And you're still going pretty deep with a normal leach field. But with a pit system, we've recommended those in certain sites where you're actually going down a lot further than lengthwise through a trench, so you can actually accommodate that in between trees. And the original plans had the secondary system. It was going to our client, when we remove a tree, we basically remove all the brush, haul all the wood, grind the stump. Everything's basically hauled off site.
Thank you.
I have a question. You talked about the deep pit that you go down further, but what if you hit a lot of rock, such as happened on this, you know, when they were bringing the sewer line up? And I do remember on the road that I live, when they brought in natural gas, the gas company didn't make any money because they had to. They hit so much rock that they had to do a lot more excavation than they had anticipated.
The only example I can think of, we had a client that actually had to do a tree protection plan, and and install pits because they had a septic system failure. I think it was up off Del Rio Road, I believe, up in Las Encinas, and I think they hit quite a bit of rock, and it was, I think it slows the process way down. I know it's hard on the equipment, but I can't really answer as far as what exact consistency of rock makes it impossible. Steve, maybe you know a little bit more. You could maybe help me with this.
On a deep pit system, what they do is they're basically vertical trenches, so they have the same absorption characters of a conventional system, except they're up and down, and as Chip pointed out, they do have less impact on the surrounding terrain. What they have to do when they put those in, they actually drill a test pit, and they do a deep percolation test to confirm how the pit perks. So that's when you'd find out how it perks, depending on what material it goes through. You'd have to do the same type of perk test.
Okay. And I have another question for the arborist. With regard to the drainage, isn't that drainage, the water diversion, all underground? It's brought down to the swale area?
Correct.
Okay, so actually the trees, the only impact to the trees will be to put in the drainage pipe. You're not going to be increasing the flow of water, the amount of water, are you?
No, that where the house is going to be located, it's high in the watershed, and it's almost in a basin as it sits, and kind of at the bottom of the driveway, which would basically where the beginning of that blue line is, that's where this real swale in that property starts. It's slight up above the house, and then it gets more concentrated down below the house. And I think right at the beginning of that blue line is where
300 Ardilla, the adjacent lot to the structure they're applying a permit for. Have some major concerns here over animal protection, such as deer, squirrels, kit foxes are in the area, and I think that would be a major impact by removing these trees. My second concern is also for drainage. If you disrupt the natural creek, I think that will be a problem. The way I understand, it's going to be redesigned to the rear of the house. There's excessive water being moved down this road here. I've been here since 1980, and I've seen quite a major impact as far as the houses downstream also, with water overflowing their driveways and causing other problems on the street. And I have a question also about the land survey, which I think is very important. If this lot has had a four-corner survey done on it, seeing that it's adjacent to my property, I think this is important also. I understand it's a colony lot, and from what I understand, it has not been surveyed from the 60s. And right now I feel that our street has got a major problem with the sewer line in there. It's very unsafe to be going up and down the road. People don't want to seem to slow down whatsoever. And I know this doesn't basically go with this issue of this house, but it is a major concern if he does hook up to the sewer. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you. And we'll get your questions answered after everybody has spoken. Is there anybody else?
My name is Donald Cross. I live at 5185, approximately across the street from where this resident is going in. I would like to know more about how the road, Ardilla Avenue, not Ardilla Road, is going to look after this is all done. I think that it needs some curbing to channel water. The water is seriously eroding the banks along the road. And I would also like to know if the road is going to be resurfaced after these trenches are repaired. It just seems to me like that sewer line should be part of this project. From what I understand, that when a building goes in like this, that it was my understanding that it was required for the sewer line to be run up there, but from what I heard earlier, I guess it's not. But That was all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments.
Hi there. I'm Julia Cuccinella. I'm a resident at 5200 Ardilla, which is the lot directly above this lot. And I do have some concerns as well. I don't know if the property owner knows that there's a culvert that comes directly under my driveways and through my lower yard. And the culvert, it's kind of buried under weeds and stuff, so I don't know if they realize that's there or not. I'm sure they found it, but it comes directly through the middle of that lot. Looks to be where that house is going to be as well. So that might be something to look into. I can't. It's directly in the middle above on the top of that lot. So that's a water issue.
Excuse me. Would you put your pointer up there so that we have an idea? She can tell you if you've got it right.
It's right in there, yeah.
It is?
Somewhere.
Okay.
I mean, I can't tell just because it's so far away. But anyway, so that's just a question I have regarding that water drainage there. I, again, want to reiterate, we do have a severe water drainage issue. It all comes down from the houses above, and it pools. And, I mean, last year, not so bad because we didn't have so much rain. But the year before, we had a lot of flooding. So that's one major concern. I also want to ask questions about, I know this is tree-related right now, but noise issues. What time will they start cutting trees, and how late are they going to work? What days of the week? We all live there and sleep there and work, and so I just want to make sure, because I've lived in other areas where people started working before the time was allowed, and that's really important to me, because I live right next to this proposed area, so...
Excuse me, would you can provide a few more details? You say there's a lot of water at times that's flowing, and
yes.
What happens?
During the rains, well, it starts a few houses up, and then you get a little flooding. So,
and by flooding, what do you mean?
In their garage, and then they have a pump to pump it out. So I don't know what their issue is, but something like that. So then it pumps onto the lot next to them, goes over their driveway, and then thank goodness I have two culverts under my driveway across like a meadow, and then there's another culvert under the other driveway. I have a big U-shaped driveway, but part of it's an easement onto this property, and that culvert drains directly into whatever you want to call that creek area there. So,
Are you talking about the swale?
Swale. Correct. So there's not only the drainage coming down the hill above, you know, looking directly at the house above the hill, which you guys have noted.
There's a drainage from adjacent properties.
From the adjacent properties coming down the sides. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Anybody else? Okay. I would like the city engineer to address the issue of the culvert that was there. Has that been taken into consideration with regard to the drainage issues on this property? And then also the excessive, you know, I mean, the fact that there's a lot of water running down into that swale there from other properties. And these are problems. So could you...
I'd be happy to address them. I did do a site visit, two site visits to the project, and I happened to actually find the culvert that she was talking about. I was just snooping around in there, and because I always am looking for culverts, and I did notice she had a almost three-quarter buried culvert that didn't look like it was very effective. And we did look upstream. There is a substantial tributary area upstream, and it seems like people upstream that had built their houses, such as the gentleman she mentioned whose garage flooded, which I didn't see, that typically what happens with those is people don't mitigate for drainage problems when they build their homes, and the garage sounds like it was probably built too low or in a drainage area. And so I would guess that the problems upstream are probably caused by insufficient, you know, drainage facilities through the project when they extended their driveways.
Okay, but how does this, with regard to that swale that you have there, and the fact that you have the leach fields in the, you know, in the area there.
And the swale there that we did see will require, when this comes in for construction documents, that that culvert is sized to carry the upstream flow. So they'll have to calculate what the tributary area is and then size that culvert to make sure that the water does pass through this project. And just to cover a couple more topics that were addressed. Ardea Road does have a lot of drainage problems itself. We noted downstream of this house, approximately one or two parcels, it looks like there's a large valley that actually drains onto the road, and then when there's enough flow, it looks like it comes across the road. So there is, you know, poor drainage on this road, and the water is everywhere. Having to do with the sewer trench, again, we're going to make sure that that sewer trench is flat and not and doesn't settle. However, sewer trenches on old roads are a problem. If I had my way, I would pave the whole road every time. We did that when we extended the sewer on North El Camino Real. We paved the entire road, made a much nicer trench. However, I cannot require that to be paved.
Could you explain to the applicants why you can't require that that be paved? Or why there aren't any going to be any curbs or anything like that?
I'd be happy to. We have certain codes in the municipal code that we're governed by when people do work, and we can't require mitigation that is beyond their project. So when someone puts in a sewer line, we have to require that the trench be repaired and that it be fixed to standards, but we can't require them to pave the entire road because that's a mitigation measure beyond their responsibility, and it would be a large cost to them, and we just can't arbitrarily, you know, require them to make those changes. And as far as drainage improvements up the road, same thing. We've had an historic drainage problem here. We can't suddenly come in and require someone to mitigate old problems. We can not let them make it worse. So if someone's exacerbating a drainage problem or causing more drainage problems, we certainly address that and try to get them to mitigate those problems. And I believe I just had one, I heard one more concern, and that is speeding and traffic on this road. This road does have traffic problems. We have addressed traffic problems before. There are some. It is a cutoff from the high school to In-N-Out Burger, and the police department's constantly patrolling this, and we're looking at ways of keeping people slow on this road, but speeding is a problem on this road.
Okay, and then the issue of a land survey.
Oh, Commissioner O'Keefe, could I, while we're on this same topic, follow up, please? I believe on commercial projects, it is a requirement to have a detention pond so that the rate of water flow through the property is unchanged from prior to construction to after. Is there the same kind of requirement for residential or not? Or what, if not, what is going to happen to the folks downstream if the water flow is greater than before? And what's going to happen to the folks upstream if the water flow is less?
A very good question. Again, if somebody is causing an impact to downstream facilities in order to increase the drainage, whether it's a residential or a commercial project, we do require what's called a 52 basins, which means there is a 50-year event that goes into that basin and it releases out at a two-year rate. That's per our municipal code again. On residential projects, when they drain into a drainage facility such as a swale or a basin, we typically have not required detention facilities. However, if we see some sort of downstream problem, we would require that, and I believe on this project they do have detention facilities in order to mitigate the downstream flow, and I just ask the planners to confirm that.
Yes, they have a subsurface detention system right here at the top of the swale.
Okay.
So that will, again, collect the water and release it at a mitigated rate to they don't stop the water. All they do is make sure it doesn't get worse when they do this development.
Thanks. I missed that on the drawings. Thank you.
Okay, and then a question was asked about a land survey. Do you require a survey?
We do not require a survey unless the house is close to the setbacks, and we need the confirmation that they're not over their setbacks.
Okay. And then I think a couple questions for staff. Question was asked about the noise issues. Would you please explain to the person in the public who asked that this city's code requirements?
The city does have a noise ordinance for construction. They're allowed to operate between 7 a.m. and I believe it's 9 p.m. And we do enforce the noise ordinance on construction projects. And if anything goes on outside those hours, she's welcome to call the city.
Okay, and what about parking of the construction equipment? Again, because the same issue that came up on another project.
Yes, on the last project, the commission added a condition to designate a parking area. And if you like, we can also do that on this project.
Okay.
This project isn't quite as steep as the other one, so there will probably be some more room in the driveway for parking of construction vehicles.
Okay. It's just that they've also talked about the fact that speeding is a problem on Ardell Road there, so taking cautionary steps, I think, would be helpful. And the issue of Kit Fox.
Yes, that issue came up at the last hearing that we had on the street as well, and Atascadero is not Kit Fox habitat, so that would not be an impact that we foresee on the site.
Okay, thank you. I think that covers the questions. Are there any other comments? Okay, go ahead.
Where do I begin? Again, this is a tree issue. However, I think this is ultimately all related. I did raise the issue with staff regarding having a septic system within 100 feet of what the city refers to as a significant drainage course. I was assured that the city had looked at that drainage course, and it did not fall into the category or definition of a water course. I've heard four people testify this evening that drainage is an issue and water runoff is an issue. I've gone out and looked at the site. And it's not on this map, unfortunately. This is the drainage map. But there appears to be a pool, or what was a pool, down at the end of this significant drainage course. And there appears to be debris that is washed down into that pool. Now, from my perspective, I consider that a water course. We're hearing about neighbors flooding upstream of this site. We're hearing about neighbors flooding downstream of this site. It was even mentioned that water runs over Ardea Road, or Avenue. I realize the issue before the Planning Commission at this point is tree removals. However, there has been, in the staff report, there has been nothing to suggest that the city is in compliance with state law, which requires 100-foot separation between a water course or a significant drainage course and a leach field. And what I've heard this evening confirms what I thought to begin with. And there's no explanation of how septic tank leachate will not impact this waterway and ultimately the folks downstream. And at this point, I cannot support the tree removals. I can't support the project. It's not consistent with the law.
Any other comments? Commissioner Fonsi?
I think we've heard from the public that there is a drainage problem, and generally when you have an area that has significant problems, I think the city engineer would back me up. Generally, it's looked at as an entire area, not as a particular property-specific issue. If we were looking at the drainage district, let's say, or an overlay that could be put in this area, which may be something that needs to be done, I would be in agreement with you, Mr. Marks, but we are not. We are just dealing with tree removals, and as we know, colony lots do have a certain right to build a home, but they need to mitigate the trees. And I believe that the applicant has done this, and it would be unfair at this point in time to put this burden for the entire drainage of the entire area upon this particular property. So, in my opinion, he has done what he can do for his property to mitigate the tree removals, has sited his home properly, has tried to work with the terrain and the topography, and I believe I could vote for this.
I have some concerns about what a water course is and the 100-foot setback, and I'm getting increasingly uncomfortable because this issue is coming up. I know that it's very difficult to build in Atascadero because we're comprised of hills and vales, but there is state law, there's the basin plan, and this whole definition of what is a water course seems, I would like to know from the water quality water board if the city is meeting the requirements for the water quality board on this. And I know it's a judgment call, but we're talking about sewer. And water, you know, water doesn't know any boundaries, property lines, or anything like that. Could you weigh in on that?
Yes, I could. In preparation of the potential of this discussion, I brought a copy of the basin plan with me, and what I'd like to do is just read the definition of a water course. It says from the basin plan, minimum distance setback for water course is 100 feet. Water course where geologic conditions permit water migration. And then they define a water course. Water course, one, a natural or artificial channel for passage of water. Two, a running stream of water. Three, a natural stream fed from permanent or natural sources, including rivers, creeks, runs, or rivulets. There must be a stream, usually flowing in a particular direction, though it need not flow continuously. In a defined channel, having a bed or bank, and usually discharging in some stream or body of water. So when we went out and visited the site, we specifically looked for a bed and bank in this particular location, and we saw none. We saw it was a rounded channel with no defined channel and a no bed and bank. So that Warren and I visited the site, and we felt that it did fall under the definition that we use as a swale. And just so everyone's understands what the city does. Inside our municipal code, in the plumbing code, we have even a more stringent requirement that is in than the basin plan, because the basin plan requires a 100-foot setback from a water course. Our plumbing code requires a 50-foot setback from swales, as we define the plumbing code, as an infill draw or other natural water course with drainage areas larger than 10 acres. So what we do is, if it's not a water course per the basin plan, we drop to the swale definition, which requires a 50-foot setback, and that's where we felt this had a 50-foot setback. And I would agree, it is a judgment call. You know, two people could go out and look at a particular facility and say, no, I think that's a water course, or no, I think that's a swale, or no, I think it's neither. But staff did go out and look at it, and in our judgment, it is a swale.
Question?
Yes, go ahead.
Could you speak to the underlying principle between the separation, or for the separation of septic systems from water courses?
I am not an expert on the basin plan. I'm not a sewage expert, but I will try to speak to it. The basic concept is trying to keep, as the commissioner pointed out earlier, try to keep the leachates out of the water system. So as effluent is charged into your septic fields, it's supposed to perk down into the ground, if there's a water course too close, there could be a potential for the leachates to get into the water and move downstream. So that is the reason for the separation.
So it's to prevent pollution of our drinking water. Is that basically what we're talking about?
Pollution of water. I'm not going to go as far as say drinking water in this case, but anyway, it's okay. Pollution of water.
All right.
Probably sounds like I'm beating a dead horse, but this has been a dry year, and we had another project that came up, and the neighbors talked about how water would actually set on this certain parcel, but when it's the year is dry, it's difficult to evaluate these things. So I'm still not really comfortable that we don't know that this is a waterway, because there could be pooling of water, you know, water that is setting there during the rainy, when it does rain heavily.
The slope of the swale seemed to indicate that there wasn't any ponding or pooling in this particular location, because the water looked like it flowed downstream sufficiently.
Okay. And by the way, my comments are not directed to the tree issue. It's the definition of, you know, a waterway and whether the leach field is going to be impacting the underground water basin. Commissioner Hetherington.
Steve, do we ever go back after we look at a project like this and say it's approved, and do we ever go back and do water tests to see if there's fecal coliform or any type of total coliform counts?
No.
So what would happen if this project was approved and the 50-year flood came, and or even the 10-year flood came, and this started leaching? What would happen at that point?
If we had a storm of that magnitude, we would have drainage situations all over the city of Atascadero, so I really couldn't speak to this particular project as to what would happen.
Is there any way you can really test that with regard to a leach field? I know you can do that with other, you know, regular sewer systems, but can you test that for those kinds of things? Because, again, it disperses.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. All right, go ahead.
One of the neighbors, Julia, and I'm sorry, I did not get her last name, had a concern about the hours of construction, and I understand Ms. Taylor spoke to that, and I think you said it was 7 a.m. to something else.
9
p.m. But those are only city requirements, and I'd like to think that the Planning Commission can at times help facilitate good relationships between neighbors. And I know when I hired contractors to build a workshop on my property, I put in my spec that no construction would take place prior to 8 a.m. in the morning, nor after 6 p.m. in the evening. And I know my neighbors appreciated that, and I don't know if the applicant would care to facilitate some sort of compromise like that, but I just thought I'd throw that out there.
Well, could we ask staff, can the commissioners put restrictions on like that?
Not on this kind of application.
Okay.
You could if it was a planned development or something where you had the ability to mitigate an environmental impact. This is just a tree removal, so you're only limited to the tree issue. And the noise issue isn't something that we can condition on this. They'll just be subject to our standard noise ordinance. Now, if the applicant just wants to, as a good neighbor, follow a higher standard, that's completely acceptable.
Okay, what about designating parking for the
construction? No, that's not before you either.
Okay, so neither one of those things.
Yeah, you're really going to have to limit yourself to the findings that are before you, which is, are these tree removals justified?
Okay. All right. Is there a motion?
Yes.
Go ahead.
I move that we
support staff's recommendation that the Planning Commission adopt Resolution PC 2007-0081, approving the request to remove two live oaks and three valley oaks, subject to the guidelines and mitigation required by the Atascadero Municipal Code and Native Tree Ordinance.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
Moved and seconded. Roll call.
Commissioner Jack?
Yes.
Commissioner O'Grady?
Before I vote, I would just like to compliment Commissioner Marks on raising the sensitivity of this body to these water course issues. I've learned a lot tonight, and I'm sure in the future what we've learned tonight is, and from Mr. Kahn, is going to be applicable to other projects that we run into. However, based on my own observations of the condition of the water course, I vote yes.
Commissioner Hetherington?
No, and I'm going to predicate it on the fact that I'm not comfortable with the drainage situation and the impact of the trees that are going to remain.
Commissioner Marks?
No.
Vice Chairperson Fonzie?
Yes.
Chairperson O'Keefe?
Yes.
4-2, motion passes.
Okay. So we'll move on to our next item, which is appearance review for residential projects.
Yes, good evening, Madam Chair, members of the Commission. Tonight we have a staff presentation for you of staff work and city work rather than of developer applications to you. So we're going to take our time and walk you through this presentation. And just before I even commence this, I'd like to introduce the team. Of course, myself as your Deputy Director of Community Development. And to my left, Senior Planner Kelly Gleason and Assistant Planner Callie Taylor. The three of us have worked together on this presentation for you, and as you know, work diligently and daily on appearance review, of which much of this comes to your body for approval or recommendations of approval to the City Council. So with that, I'm going to start the presentation with a little general plan and zoning overview. You may be familiar with, and so some of this might be refreshing your memory, or maybe little bits of it may be new information for you. Starting with the general plan, and starting with the beginnings of Atascadero, in 1913, of course, E.G. Lewis's model community for Atascadero. This was his vision of accommodating both urban and rural lifestyle. He accommodates this through 38 square miles of the ranch, which becomes Atascadero. And in the general plan, acknowledging this historic lot pattern, you see in the slide that the compact urban core of Atascadero, and then as it migrates out from the core into larger lots, in which we coined the term elbow room. The general plan, on the fourth page of the general plan, early in the general plan, there's an immediate reference to smart growth and the smart growth principles. And smart growth principles for Atascadero very much relate to a more compact, walkable community in that we focus in that urban core area, and that's where most of our smart growth principles apply, and also in which much of our presentation tonight applies. Infill opportunities, putting the right development, the right type of development in the right place, focusing growth where services already exist, higher density in the urban core to support economic vitality, multifamily and mixed-use development within that core area, preserving open space out on the outer edges, and clustering development close to existing services to minimize impacts with new subdivisions. Then we get into plan developments, and plan developments, you actually review all the plan developments that come through staff and then go off to City Council for final approval. With plan development overlay zones, they're in place to encourage a higher quality of development. They deal with setbacks, minimizing lot size. There are public benefits. Public benefits slide is in every presentation we bring to you on these projects. And quite often there's questions from the Commission about, does the project actually meet a public benefit? And what does that mean? So in our presentation, we're going to go into detail about that. But
Just in brief, it deals with the architecture and landscape and materials and design, neighborhood definition, neighborhood meaning. So with plan developments, in terms of zoning, there are PDs in the single-family zones and then in the multifamily zones, and they're treated a little bit differently. And you've heard references to new PDs with new numbers and then these reusable PDs. So just quickly again, with PDs in the single-family zones, we have the PD 17. That's in the RSFX zone. That RSFX zone is half-acre minimum lot size. And we always stumble across, well, if the minimum lot size is half-acre, how can you get more or accommodate more development? Well, in the general plan in that zone, it calls for the ability to go to 4 units per acre. But to do that, you apply for a plan development. And, of course, then there's the public benefit in return for that higher density. So that's part of the infilling in these specific zones. There's not many of these RSFX zones, but where they are, it was deemed that it would be appropriate to go higher density with more control and design aesthetic. Then we also have the PD16, which is the clustering of small lots to preserve open space. We've had some of those recently. And again, that's more of an exchange of open space for the clustering. And I think we've dealt with that recent enough to not have to review that in more detail than what I've just mentioned. Then in the multifamily zones, we have the PD7 and the PD25. That PD7 was one of the earlier PDs. That seven deals with what I would refer to as the more traditional single-family small lots. Quite often in cities you have the RX6, meaning the 6,000-square-foot lot with a traditional house on it, and that's how we accommodate that. In Atascadero, we don't have that zoning, so it's accommodated through the PD7 in the multifamily. That allows quite often that the incentive to a developer in using that PD is to subdivide into single-family lots with single-family homes rather than doing the multifamily. That could be a benefit, even though it may maintain or decrease density, in terms of historic preservation, for instance, where we're infilling or actually in neighborhood compatibility, where we're infilling in areas where some of these areas are multifamily zoned but are actually predominantly single family in character and nature. So PD7 comes into play in that regard. Without the PD7, the property owner could possibly go with a multifamily attached product that wouldn't be as compatible and would have less design control and may not be before you as an approval body. In terms of the PD25, that was our courtyard PD. That was more recent. And that was in response to providing a customer service to developers that wanted to do attached or detached, but in a courtyard format, and struggling in what would be acceptable to the commission and council. So through trial and error, we worked that out to come up with this 25 that has specific standards in terms of setbacks, in terms of courtyard design, landscaping, pavement, pedestrian street orientation, porches, the whole gamut of things that you've heard us speak to in plan developments. That makes it quite user-friendly for the development community to develop that way. And then we have the custom PDs, as you know. Those are the ones that don't quite fit. If they don't fit the 7 or the 25 or some of these other PDs, then they'll go with a custom, and that will be site-specific to that property only and will not be reusable. Mostly it's responding to the characteristics of the site. So the next slide does talk about the benefit policies. So inside the urban core, we have the use of the PD7, the 25, the 17, and customs. It deals with affordable housing. As you know, we have inclusionary housing in place, the high-quality architecture and landscape, the buffering between lots, and dealing with higher density. Outside the urban core, we have the PD16 and custom PDs. Those are dealing primarily with the natural space and natural resource elements.
Thank you, Steve. So now I'm going to turn over to our appearance review of site design and structures and what we generally go through when we do our appearance review and what we bring before you. So just in terms of the levels of review, for multifamily that are just building permits, which are less than 12 units on a lot, we do a staff-level review of those. So a lot of the condominium developments that come before you, we've done a staff-level review of the appearance of the structures based on our sort of appearance review manual and policies from the general plan. Those permits we normally see are a little bit more simple. They may not have quite as much detailing on them as the plan developments. which sort of have to meet that superior architectural design finding to be approved. So what the Planning Commission gets to see are the master planned developments, which are usually before you as a conditional use permit. These are uses that are allowed in the zone, but because of their size, over 10,000 square feet or over 12 multifamily units, require a little bit extra attention to some of the site design details to make sure that they are compatible with surrounding development. And then, of course, you see the planned developments as a recommendation to City Council. And the City Council is the final authority on those planned developments and approval of those projects. So just in terms of subdivision design, what we look for when we get in larger projects that are parts of larger subdivisions really are connections to our existing neighborhoods. We certainly want to try not to develop where we have communities or neighborhoods that are very separated from our existing community fabric. So units facing existing streets or somehow alluding to them, wrapped porches, those sorts of elements we're always looking for, pedestrian connections through walkways, street connections where appropriate. And we want to try and continue the street pattern. So the slide that you're looking at obviously shows a more traditional grid-type subdivision, and we know Atascadero, our historic street pattern is definitely winding and tree-lined, and so where we can, we do try and maintain that sort of nature, incorporating existing mature oak trees into the street design and such. So that's what we kind of look for with subdivision design. We also look to sort of maintain the natural topography and site characteristics of the site as a whole. Obviously, Atascadero has a lot of topography, has a lot of natural drainage ways, creeks, wetland areas, native oak trees, native vegetation clusters, and so when we get a larger subdivision in, we're looking to potentially preserve those areas as open space for the entire community and then the development in and of itself, and try and keep development clustered away from those areas that we'd like to maintain sort of in their more natural state. So where we also start in our subdivision design is the design of the actual street itself. So these are basically the streetscape elements that encompass the residential street. So for residential street, we like them to be a little bit more narrow so that traffic problems and speeding don't become a problem. We generally like to see a landscape planter that sort of separates the sidewalk from the street so that there's that element of safety, and it's also an element of softening. When the trees become large and have a lot of canopy area, they tend to sort of create a sense of enclosure, which is generally a little bit safer feeling and creates a different character for the street than something like a El Camino Real, which is wider and more commercial in nature. And then, you know, the porches are sort of part of the streetscape as well, and the entry features into a house. It doesn't necessarily have to be a porch, but to have sort of that transition open space between sort of more the public realm and then the private realm sort of lends a character to the neighborhood in and of itself, and sort of helps sort of the house talk to the street and the street talk to the house, and likewise the people enjoying the space in between. So these are just some examples of some streets in town that have some good features. This is Atascadero Avenue, so it's one of our residential streets as it hits Mora Road, but E.G. Lewis definitely saw the importance of street trees back in the day, and we have some beautiful sycamores all along Atascadero Avenue and streets like Tecarita, which create sort of that outdoor room and sense that it's a nice place to walk even though it is a busy street. And then these are some newer developments down here. So you can see we've incorporated the landscape planters and the detached sidewalks with the landscaping, porch features, and places for kids to ride bikes and walk along their neighborhood. And we do have control over some landscaping for planned developments and for master plans of development. We want to make sure that the landscaping is appropriate for the use it's designed for. So in a park setting for an open space amenity, you might have some more turf area depending on what it is. We want to make sure that we have a good mixture of softscape and hardscape to really make that amenity a useful portion of the site. And then we also pay attention to our front yard landscaping and planned development projects, making sure street trees are planted if we don't have a parkway, focusing on some drought-tolerant landscaping as turf and areas to play are not generally located in the front yard. We're also, for commercial projects or for subdivision multifamily plan developments, we want to make sure sort of that the planter size accommodates the plants. And so when we talk about high quality architecture or landscape design, we really want to make sure that everything sort of fits and is going to grow and accentuate the architecture and the design of the development. So in terms of open space, we've seen some larger projects that accommodate some open space. A lot of our smaller projects sort of use existing facilities nearby in the neighborhood, but we have had some larger projects that accommodate their own open space, and it's appropriate to be designed into the development. So for open space amenities, we really want to make sure that they're integrated into the project design, that they're not shoved into a corner or somewhere not very accessible by the site, not just located in the least developable area of the site. Generally, we want them to be centrally located. I know the Dove Creek development was built, and that has a larger central park that a lot of residents are currently enjoying out there, as well as Apple Valley had a large, more passive park feature that was located in the center of the development that's getting a lot of use. We want the open space to sort of be a focal point when possible, so that it is a safe environment and used environment. And it can be both passive and active. The Las Lomas development up at Woodridge has a lot of trail systems through the existing open space areas, so that's an appropriate open space amenity as well, other than just a park. And integrating trail systems and then pedestrian connections possibly to existing parks, existing neighborhoods through a green space or open space area. So these are just some examples of some of the parks that are currently out there and sort of the differences in their use and their size. So this is the park at Dove Creek, which has some active park features, also has a gazebo and a large lawn area for play. And then this is one of our smaller sort of tot lots and what you would normally see in a smaller development for a tot lot with one play structure and some benches around, both useful in their own way. So for small lot design, which is what we're talking about with a lot of these planned developments, we're really talking about making a nice appearance along the streetscape and maintaining that character. So generally, one of the main contributing factors to that is sort of minimizing the appearance of the garage along the street. Definitely, the garage is a very vehicular-focused element, and so to the degree that we can minimize that, we bring people and life back to the street. So one of our options, we have a side-loading garage option that's used in many occasions to sort of minimize the appearance of the garage. We definitely, in most PDs, try and recess the front of the garage from the facade of the house. You can detach the garage at the rear of the site. I know that the PD 17, based on the lot size requirements, accommodates that very well. And then for very narrow lots, when the garage might dominate, if it's a normal two-car garage based on the narrowness of the lot, we can do like a tandem garage so that the front appearance is a one-car garage, but it actually does accommodate two cars, which is preferable for single-family detached lots. And then as Steve mentioned, we have our PD 25, which was our parking court plan development. And there are certain features that we wrote into the PD 25 to make sure that the little courts that we got were truly pleasing and higher quality and did blend with the existing neighborhood. So what we tried to avoid with the parking court design were very small entries, some blank facades along the parking court, the garage at the end of the parking court. So what we paid attention to when we wrote the PD 25 standards is treating this courtyard kind of like a little mini street, requiring little street trees along the courtyard, requiring the architecture to face both the existing street and the parking court. We require it to be all in pavers so that it softens the appearance and sort of is a little bit more inviting to pedestrians because they're not necessarily provided with a sidewalk up the parking court. And then we have a landscape feature required at the terminus of the parking court so that you don't get a very garage-dominated view looking down that court. So these are some examples of some parking courts, some of them PDs and some of them just regular multifamily developments. So this one up here, it's a regular multifamily development, so some of their setbacks are a little bit smaller. But you can see that with the articulation of the facades and the use of the pavers and the use of appropriate landscaping, this project turned out with a very nice feel when you drive up into it. This project here on San Jacinto and Almeida is actually a PD7, but was designed with a lot of the parking court characteristics as we were sort of phasing into that style of development. And their use of pavers, I've heard from the people that live there, make it very inviting. They have a lot of block parties on those pavers where they wouldn't normally if they were asphalt. So landscaping, we pay attention to landscaping along that parking court because we know it is minimized. We know the setbacks are smaller. We know it's a higher density development. But we feel that we've written into the PD25 those elements that sort of soften that and mitigate for that higher density and less setback area. And then the articulated entries along the parking court, the porches, the courtyard areas are very important when there is that minimized setback to give it sort of a friendly feel. And now I'll turn it over to Callie.
Another important aspect that we're looking at in plan developments is the architecture itself. The primary focus when we do new developments is that they borrow elements of the original colony style. Colony houses in Atascadero were mainly built between 1915 and 1924. So we're looking at the original E.G. Lewis type style. And in Atascadero, there's actually quite an eclectic mix of different styles. We see predominantly craftsman homes, but there's also several with an Italian Renaissance influence, classical elements, and we get a Spanish eclectic influence on a lot of our homes. So these are a good place to start for pulling elements that we can use in our new developments. It's key to remember that we're not necessarily copying the old colony homes. We're trying to complement them and pull, positive elements from them into our new developments. So here we see some homes that use nice porches, articulated elements, some other features that we would see in a colony home. Some important things that we look at that we tried to match up with the colony style would be form, massing, detailing, and materials. When we're looking at, say, standard appearance review for like a multifamily project or a condo development, form and massing tend to be the key ones that we look at there, and we try to get some of the detailing and materials in there as well. When we're looking at a PD, we're looking really for superior architectural detailing and materials, so really a higher level of architecture than a standard multifamily project. When we look at the form and massing, there's a couple of key things to consider here. One of the big things is the size and scale of the buildings. So when we look at an elevation, it should really seem proportional. We look for paired windows, substantial porch elements, things like that when we're looking at elevations. Then when we translate that into a 3D image, to look at it from all sides of the building, we want to make sure that there's really an articulation of other elements coming into just the box building. We're looking at how the porch connects, how the roof lines connect, other elements like that that really go into making a building come together. Here we see some examples where the porch is a predominant feature on this one. We see the grouped windows and the additional detailing and between the siding and maybe a smooth stucco on top. Smooth stucco and siding tend to be traditional elements that we saw in colony homes, and it's a nice thing to nice feature to pull out when we're doing new developments. Here we see more of a typical craftsman home with the low-pitched gables, the grouped windows, and the large columns on the porches. Having this wider porch is really a key feature. A lot of times we see a little bit smaller porches, and when we make those larger, it makes a substantial difference on the front of the facade. Here we also see the importance of setting the garages back further so that the porches become really the key element, and it creates just a much nicer streetscape. There are several different elements we can get into with detailing, and on our next slide we actually see some photos of some houses around town that use these different details. When we're looking at colony homes, so we could be looking here at the porches with the wider brackets, and then we can compare that to a new development where they've actually borrowed certain elements of from the original colony home and put it into the new development. Here we see some original brackets and detailing along the roof, the grouped windows, and then in a new home, we see the gable above the roof, the grouped windows here, and these similar brackets. Shutters and windows are always a good detail to include. Here on this original colony home, we see some really intricate detailing with the shingles and some additional molding underneath the roofs, and in a new structure, how they've borrowed some of those elements and used them in a modern way. Colors and materials are actually a really important thing that we pay attention to in design review. In a Tuscadero, we really tend to go more with earth tones, some of those natural, earthy colors. And these can be anywhere from reds or greens, caramel colors. And it's really just how they're the tone of the colors and how they go together. And then we see the different types of rock and materials that you can add in there to really accentuate that the facades. Here we see an example of three different porches, and you can see how the different materials on the roofs, the materials of the porch, can really create some different feelings. So you can have the same type of porch, and it can look completely different on three separate houses. Here we see some examples of some good color schemes that we have around town with the deep browns, some nice greens and reds mixed in. So we're not trying to necessarily limit to a certain color palette, just make them really compatible with architecture in the Tascadero. These are some images of some new development in a Tascadero, and you can see here how the columns are come out, and they're really a substantial feature. We do also have some really nice Spanish-style homes, and that's a nice element to copy, or not necessarily copy, but to emulate and borrow those features from.
Or in basic planning sense, planning in terms of zoning is, cities have, and particularly suburbs have, conventional zoning, and that's very similar to really what we have in our zoning ordinance. You open it up, it segregates, where you look at the map, the zoning map, which comes down from the general plan, and you see all these colors that segregate all the uses that can occur within the city. And then within that, you go to the zoning text, and the zoning text gives you specific standards for setbacks, et cetera, on how to develop the site or the parameters in which you can develop the site. There's some appearance review, there's certain levels of appearance review that we refer to, but this is all the basic zoning criteria before you get into the plan development, specific plans and things, the very creative items that were presented to you tonight. So that's really termed conventional zoning, and that is the basis of which we have our zoning in Atascadero, but then we have all these other tools. Then there's form-based zoning that's become increasingly popular in terms of a term, in terms of a way to look at zoning and to write zoning ordinances. It's also referred to as smart codes. It is grounded in smart growth principles. It does deal with the rural to urban transect. Basically, what the way I would boil it down is you're separating the uses in the conventional zoning, and you're doing kind of a transect zone of almost like the elbow room from more intense mix of uses that could be more comfortable rather than segregating them to the more rural uses and what you would find in a mix of rural uses. You have the conventional suburban development that's associated with that conventional zoning versus the different intensities of mixed uses. So that's part of it. Then as we go into the next slide, you see there's an example there of a form-based code, smart code, and just a segment. The part that's blown up is just a segment of a page. And the form-based codes would be several pages, but it's very visual. It's less text-oriented. And it's to provide more flexibility. You know, we talked to you about the plan developments and all the things that are flexible and just relaxing that stringent conventional zoning text into something that works for the site. The form-based code does that, but does that in more of an urban character. So you see form-based codes more successful in traditional neighborhoods, things on a transect, on a grid, where you're looking for those are. If you'd like more information, you can look online. There's quite a few websites on it because it is very, very trendy at this time. There are some communities that have adopted it. You'll note when you look into those communities that they've adopted it for specific areas in their city. Maybe in their downtown they've adopted it, and it could work nicely there, but you won't necessarily see it adopted citywide, although that could be the case. Places like Atascadero, it's not likely you'll see that. SmartCodeCentral.com is the example that we have before you on the slide tonight. So then moving on to some conclusionary slides here, I just wanted to review with you sort of in a checklist format some of the things that we've gone over and what are important to you as commissioners when you're reviewing your projects. This first slide is on subdivision design. We did review that the designing, you know, integrating the design into the site, into the landscape and the topography of the site, connectivity in terms of connecting those pedestrian ways, whether the paseos or sidewalks, as well as connecting the streets and vehicular ways. Connecting to open space amenities or any amenities, maybe even getting into downtown from the outskirts of downtown. Then the next slide is on the quality of architecture, which Gally spent quite a bit of time on, and focusing in on the form and massing of those buildings. So we start with the shapes of the buildings, then we break it down into the very detailed components of the windows, the trim, the materials, the feel, where the garage is placed, color, and even texture. Textures could even come in color as well as the material. And then our third slide deals with the landscape, as Kelly had reviewed with you. The appropriate use of landscape in terms of space as well as materials. We know we're into another drought cycle. We're looking at where we place turf. It's only in active areas at this point. Very rarely will you see staff bring turf to you or even a developer at this point in time. We do work with the water company, and the water company provides materials that we provide in turn to the applicants, so they have a good plant selection list. Again, very rare that you'll see. Once in a while, you'll see a palm tree or something sneak through that isn't necessarily what we're looking for. But you'll also find that staff is diligently... Well, you'll see one, but you'll see diligently there is a condition that removes that palm tree from the site plan. So it's not often that you'll see many things get past us, but once in a while... if you catch it, let us know, and we can always condition those. And then I think in our last slide, which is just generic, I just wanted to point out that this is all about customer service. It's all about provide free of charge pre-planning meetings. Many of the developers take advantage of that, so quite often they're in speaking to any one of us about a project, and quite often multiple times before they actually even submit. So for all the few times you hear the difficult, time-consuming process of a project, those are the ones that you hear few but loud. There are dozens, I can assure you, dozens of success stories where these projects have gone through this process and come out successful. Quite often they've picked up a unit where they didn't think they were going to, which could make a project more profitable. We also hear from the development community that the projects that are well-designed they're more attractive to sell, and they sell for a higher amount. This presentation, we do intend to reproduce it for you, so although you may be taking some notes, I'm sorry I didn't mention it earlier, we'll actually give you, it's fine to take notes because you may have questions, but we will be providing this to you by the next time we meet. You'll have something in printed form. It might be a little bit more detailed as this was a PowerPoint presentation, but in a sense it'll be very similar to what you have here. We're hoping you can use that as a reference guide when you're reviewing these projects as they come to you, as well as we'll make these available to the public. So again, when we have those pre-planning meetings or somebody has questions, we can provide this to them as a customer service element, something new for them. So that does conclude our presentation. We're very pleased to present this to you tonight. And of course, we have any questions if you have any, but I know you have questions all the time, so we're always available for you.
Very good, thank you.
Should we take a 5-minute break? I don't think. I know. Sure, a 5-minute break. We'll reconvene at 25:02. The Planning Commission will reconvene. Do any of you have questions of staff regarding the presentation? Go ahead. Dan?
Oftentimes, my bedtime reading consists of the general plan, and I don't last too long, I confess, but but thank you for a very thorough and informative report. Prompted a couple questions. As I recall, there was a chart in one section.
On the west side of town, for the most part, on the large lots, or just straight subdivisions, even some PD-16s that are simply made to preserve open space and cluster, don't have sort of that same appearance review. But it's mostly for commercial and multifamily developments and then planned developments as well.
Just to follow up, how, before I became a planning commissioner, I attended a couple of meetings, and I remember one meeting in particular that stuck with me. I believe it was on the west side, large lots, nice houses. And then someone put up an accessory structure. And I think it was some sort of a shop that was going to restore cars or something. It might have been a metal building. I don't remember the architectural details, but it was, to me, such a blight on the neighborhood. And some of the neighbors spoke, and I really felt badly that there was no way to massage that to make it blend in. Is there any way we can make progress here in Atascadero for that?
We recently did change our code, and I'm not sure it completely alleviates the problem, but there's generally no appearance review on accessory structures. However, when we did a code text update for accessory structures, we allowed them to be larger than 50% of the house if you went through a conditional use permit process. And through that process, we then look at appearance review and sort of compatibility with the neighborhood, simply because it's getting to a much larger structure than would normally be sort of, you know, blending in on the site. We also implemented that when you have over two accessory structures and maybe it starts to be a little bit less residential in nature, or, you know, you get to three, four, or five accessory structures on one lot, that also requires the minor CUP so that you can look at those issues in terms of how they affect the neighborhood.
Go ahead.
Yes, I'd also like to thank staff. Very enlightening in some of it, and it's, you know, just being able to provide that overall look and feel to the community is makes it really nice, and understanding some more of the urban infill and how that all works was very interesting. Thank you.
Just kind of a follow-up with your comment. There was a high learning curve, and some of you weren't able to go on the tours that were
hard to figure out how much room they take up on the lot just from the blueprints. And I'm wondering how you deal with that as planners to determine if they're too large or they're too tight.
Callie and I studied architecture for a while. with our PD-25, I guess we'll start with the PD-7, was sort of one of our first sort of small lot development ones, and that particular plan development requires that the second floor only be like 75% of the first floor, so that you don't get a straight vertical mass, and it requires them to break up the facade of the building somewhat, although even sometimes then sort of the rear of the unit can look a little tall. So that's sort of how the PD-7 sort of came into realizing that issue. The PD-25 is a more urban PD, and so it does allow sort of a more massive building, but our lot coverage standard is actually they can only take up a smaller percentage of the lot than with a PD-7, and so it forces you to a more compact two-story design with a little bit more landscape area around it. So, in general, when you're looking at the massing of the building, you are looking for sort of features that help articulate the facade. You are looking for, you know, the porch that pops out or an element that sort of recessed. So you're looking for sort of the non-box.
One of the things that was very helpful, and it's been some time ago, but I believe you did this presentation, Steve, is you had some examples of good and bad. And it's, you know, the visual really speaks to me better than the word. You had some examples where you took the building apart and you had it into the top portion and the middle portion and the bottom portion, and that was actually very helpful. And I don't know whether this is something you could bring back to us, or rerun your PowerPoint again, but that helped me a great deal because I could specifically look at the individual features. And one other suggestion, if I could, we've looked at the residential end of things, and we do see mostly residential, but I think in the very near future we're going to be seeing some commercial. And we need to have some guidelines that would be specific on how do you examine a commercial building for excellence. And
yes, I'd like to comment on both of those.
Thank you.
First, breaking that, I really enjoy that slide as well. What we'll do is we'll put that in, so you'll have that in your printed material, and so with the public. That was a good slide. In that slide, what it does is it breaks forms down to, they all start with a simple box. No matter how you cut it, that's where these buildings start out. And they, you basically add boxes in different sizes. And we also felt that it would be, we envision this as, yes, we're going to come back to you in commercial to answer your question, but we also envision this as Chapter 2. So Chapter 2 will come to you with commercial, because commercial is dealt with quite differently. Maybe in terms of massing in those boxes, that's pretty much the similarities between residential and commercial. And from there, things depart very quickly. Different purpose, different format, different streets, different uses. So we will return to you. I don't have a timeline, but we'd like to do that this year. Thank you.
Pam.
I can't thank you enough. I know that I had a real struggle on the Rosario property trying to pull out some sort of architectural historical parallel. So this, it helped me immensely personally, so I want to thank you for that. I also want to thank you for the opportunity for the educational part of what you do when you're sitting down planning these things. I think it's vitally important that the community have access to it via AGP. So I want to encourage you, when we have light agendas, do this as much as you can, with the commercial, with, drainage, with, any type of subject matter that, would benefit our community. So thank you.
And I'd like to thank you as well. We have a project that's coming up in the future, Eagle Creek. How does that fit into all of this? Is that would bits and pieces of that perhaps be PDs, or is the whole thing a PD, or how would you address that?
For now, you can think of it that way. It would actually come in under a specific plan, which would be, think of it as a PD for now. And all the components that were reviewed with you tonight would be reviewed with you and in that document. So it could be as detailed as the little details we took you into as far as window details, et cetera. Doesn't have to be, but it could be. So it could hold design components to it. It's a much grander plan, but it's essentially a master plan, very master plan of the entire project area.
Thank you.
I have a couple questions. You made the comment that if there are 12 units or more, or it's over 12 units, then there has to be a master plan. What is a master plan in relationship to a plan development?
Yeah, and with like Southside Villas down there next to Dove Creek, that was a 80-some-odd unit development, I believe. So that came in before you as a conditional use permit. And under that conditional use permit, it was not a PD. They did not subdivide. But under the conditional use permit, you reviewed the architecture, the landscaping, the site design layout, the tot lots, some of the project amenities, and that was sort of within your scope under that conditional use permit.
But what is a master plan?
We process those as conditional use permits. So there's two different kinds of conditional use permits, and some conditional use permits are brought to you for the use of the land.
Okay.
They're listed in the zoning code as conditional uses. They're uses that may be small but may have a large impact on the surrounding neighborhood. And so you're reviewing them simply for the use. Is the use appropriate? And then when projects get larger, you're reviewing a conditional use permit for site design, because then the mass and the scale of the project becomes more.
Okay.
And I just wanted to add to that, too, is one of the key differences when you see that CUP, Master Plan of Development, under a PD, That's to separate it from the zone change of the PD itself, so that the CUP and that master plan aren't locked into the zone change, which is a council determination. So if things have to be amended or such, they can come back to the Planning Commission. Sometimes there's that small percentage of change that staff can handle. So again, that's a kind of a customer service orientation. The council doesn't need to necessarily see more minor changes. Those are things that can be dealt with at staff level or at the Planning Commission. So that's an actual key operational issue or reason for having that CUP master plan of development.
Okay, now the Woodlands was a specific plan. Would you give me a definition of a specific plan area?
I don't know if I have the text definition of it. It's allowed by state in California, so it's actually a legal definition in which a city may zone an area as a specific plan that supersedes all the zoning, all the zoning designations of the project area. It is required to be consistent with the general plan, so it doesn't go too far out of bounds. But it does create, as you know from the Woodlands, a set of subzones. I would say where it will identify uses, and then within that, when we talked about design, it could also go into detail of design, but it certainly would accommodate or would include infrastructure, roads, streets, sidewalks, just about everything to have an inclusive master planned area.
Okay, the parking courts. Can you give me an example by address or location of the PD 25? I'm trying to remember.
I don't believe we currently have any built there. They're a little too new. I think it's only a couple years old, and so a lot of them are going through the building permit process. What would be close to a parking court style development is it was a PD 7 on the corner of San Jacinto and Almeida. That one was done with all pavers. However, probably the garage designs would be a little bit different and the landscaping would be different, but that one's fairly close to a PD 25. What you'll find a lot with the PD25s that have currently been approved that are going through a building permit process is that they're usually duplex units, because through the PD25 you can do an attached product for individual sale. But in terms of just the layout of the court and the landscaping, the corner of San Jacinto and Almeida would be close.
Okay. And what was the PD for the one on, Atascadero Avenue, where you had some of the units facing to the front, and then the others, and they were some of them were duplexes, I believe.
Atascadero at the end of Sarah, where Sarah Court or Sarah Street hit?
Yes.
That was the PD 25. That one's not currently built.
Okay, but I thought that's where I was confused. I thought we had some of them come to us, that we had approved some PD 25s.
Yes, you've definitely approved some. They're just not built yet.
Oh, okay. All right. And the term side loading, what does that mean?
Basically, the garage door is not visible from the street, and you would pull in and side load the garage. So Dove Creek has a couple side loading garages as part of their PD.
I understand now. Okay. And then I'll just ask the question now, even though it doesn't relate to this. Those public trails on the Woodlands project, are they completed and can the public hike there now? There was that big open space, and that was supposed to be for
They're not accepted yet by the city, but they're essentially complete, and you can walk them at this time.
Okay, and where can you find out where they start?
Well, having been out on the site, there are trail markers there where they start, so you'll see them as you enter up their main entry drive.
And through their normal evolutionary process, they go up, they deteriorate, they come back on. Do we have a plan to tie in with the smart growth of redoing, reconfiguring the strip malls?
Yes, it's really a question of the property owners if they'd like to partake in intensifying their use up and down El Camino Real, which is primarily where you're referring. The general plan, for instance, allows for mixed use in key mid-block locations up and down El Camino. So we've had some projects not built but proposed and actually run through the Planning Commission and Council for approval. And it remains to be seen if those will be built in the near future at any time. But I think that would be one of the key smart growth principles, is intensifying that area for activity and then hopefully encouraging more commercial use in areas that are highly underutilized. Oh, you know, I guess we're mentioning Colony Square, certainly a key example. There we removed a large strip mall project, and infilling it with a highly intense use.
Okay, do you want to give your report then on the Andy Fedco?
Sure. At a past Planning Commission meeting, the Commission did ask staff to look into, I actually don't have the address in front of me, but a PD along El Camino Real, and the lack of progress on it, and that was one with the Colony House in the north end of town. And we did visit the site, noted particularly the one tree out in one of the roundabouts having more dieback than some of the others. However, we also noticed that there's a bit of dieback on many of the trees, some of them even not even on the site, the oak trees in the vicinity. That one, of course, had much more.
That's probably related to the drought, though, because
right.
There's a lot of trees that have been stressed.
Of course, that one was impacted, though, in the median,
right.
So we did note that. So I do have some more information for you on this. So we checked on permits. We wanted to know the status of permits, and there was a request for extension. The extension was granted, so the permits are currently active out on that project, even though you don't see construction activity. However, there have been no inspections, thus requesting the extensions. There's been no inspections this year out on that site, so effectively there have been no significant weeks. So that remains to be seen if that will happen, but that's been the indication. So we're looking forward to hopefully that picking up some steam, although I'm sure it will be slow.
So when did he say a couple weeks? When did you last?
It's been about a couple weeks now. So when they say a couple weeks, I imagine within 2 to 4 weeks.
Okay.
So what we can do is we can watch this, and if nothing happens in the next couple weeks, we can try to make contact again.
Well, a couple of weeks and a couple of weeks and a couple of weeks.
It's true.
Okay.
But that's our progress report for you.
And in the event he doesn't start work in a couple weeks or do something to protect that Colony House, and also doesn't start work in a couple weeks to do something about erosion control where the around the trees where they did all the grading, they lowered the level there, you know, for the streets and things like that, so you have these trees sitting up like little islands. What will the city do?
If there's erosion issues, those will be handled. What will happen is the city, this is on the city engineer's part, I don't see him here, but Public Works does go out and check all the sites. We have staff that does that for the rainy season, which starts October 15th.
Okay,
so prior to that,
my concern, yes, though, is if soil is washed away from the trees, then roots are going to be exposed. It's not the kind of erosion control where the sediment is, mm-hmm, you know, going downstream. This is about the trees. That's my concern.
Well, what we'll do is we'll contact A&T Arborist to be sure that they're looking for that.
Okay.
I think that's the best way to handle that.
All right. Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions of Steve? Okay. Director's report? Thank you, Steve.
Yes. Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the Commission, a couple quick update items for you right now. You did request copies of the Mayor and Chairperson's meeting minutes. I believe those were included in your packet. So hopefully you have those. Eagle Ranch, we've had a couple briefings with, I think, four of the commissioners so far on that project with the developer. I think Ms. Hetherington and Mr. O'Grady just drew a blank. I knew it was going to come, though. I can't see your sign. You know, plant some seeds there. Some of the things they tell you or, you know, say with quite, you know, a lot of assurance, you know, may or may not actually be the way it is. So just kind of keep that in mind as you go through, you know, that they're in the process of trying to sell you on a project. So just wanted to make sure, you know, that you kind of keep that in mind as we go through those kind of meetings. There'll probably be a series of those. And it's good that we're doing this up front, but you just need to keep that in mind.
So we need to watch out for the palm trees, right?
Yeah, you don't want to get sold a palm tree too early.
Is there any reason why we can't get one of those booklets that they have to just leave it down at City Hall here? I was having some difficulty when they were paging through it real quickly, getting my perspective on everything.
Yeah, they haven't provided one to the city.
Well, could you ask?
We have.
And they haven't?
No.
How many commissioners here would like to have a copy down here?
I would.
Okay. Would you tell them that the commission has every commissioner has requested this?
We can make a request. Just keep in mind that they don't have an application into the city, so they don't really have any legal standing where we can actually ask them to do anything. They're just
It's called public
citizens.
Relations.
And we'll express that, but they've already told us they didn't want to have that out as public information yet, but I'll let them know again that it would be desirable.
Thank
yes.
you.
I live 600 feet from Atascadero Avenue, across from Eagle Ranch. What impact is that going to have on my ability to vote?
Well, possibly none. I think the legal boundary is going to be 500 feet typically, but we're going to have to check in with the city attorney. And there's no application in at this point, so there's no concern yet. But as the application comes in, I know there's a couple other commissioners that are kind of in that vicinity and some council members as well. And just the scale of this project, you know, the conflict of interest issue will be greater than on many other projects. So we'll deal with that with the city attorney, and we'll make sure you're properly advised of what you can and can't do on that type of project.
Okay. Thank you.
The other thing, the Walmart Annex project has been submitted to the city. We received two separate general plan amendment applications. Those are going to go to the city council city in the next week or so. So we're trying to notify everybody. We expect to have very big turnout. The commission is definitely encouraged to attend the meeting. You probably want to get here fairly early. We can arrange to have seats reserved for individual commissioners just so that you can get in and hear everything like the council. So if you're not going to make it or for whatever reason, let me know so I won't have extra seats reserved because they'll be at a premium. Okay. You're going to miss all the fun. Okay. And then in terms of our next meeting, well, let me just give you an update on the next city council meeting. The last couple projects that the council or the commission looked at, the Giesinger project, the road abandonment, that's going to be on the next council agenda. The Ridgeway Court plan development will be on the next council agenda. And then the Santa Ana parcel map that was denied by the Planning Commission, that's been appealed. So that'll be going to the city council as well. I know I received a question from one of the commissioners about whether that or what basis could they appeal the commission's decision. And basically, based on the municipal code, any decision that the Planning Commission makes can be appealed to the City Council. Staff's recommendation is to support the Planning Commission's denial. The applicant has provided some additional information, almost an alternative project. The Council will be advised they can't actually take action on that if they don't want to grant or deny the appeal, but maybe study this alternative further, which addressed a lot of the issues that were brought up at Planning Commission. The best action will be to refer that back to the Planning Commission for a new hearing. So I'm not exactly sure how that's all going to play out, but those are the types of issues we'll be talking about next week. And then in terms of your next meeting, I know Commissioner Fonzie and Jack will be absent. Commissioner O'Grady, will you be here next week? Or on the 16th?
Yes.
Okay. Got a number of items queued up there. The Eagle Creek Golf Course, the Gearhart project on the south end of town at Santa Barbara Road. That'll be coming back for the general plan amendment and master plan amendment. You'll be making a recommendation to the council on that. We've been dealing with the issue of condominium conversions and updating our ordinance. We have some moratoriums that are currently in place. That will be coming to the Planning Commission.